everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Every week, we select a given topic and invite the most important voices to discuss that topic in depth. My guest today is Mickey Willis. The idea is the plan behind Plandemic. This is an award-winning film director who has gained international recognition as an innovator of socially conscious media and technologies. In 2005, he launched the Elevate Film Festival, a global competition for inspiring films that provide solutions to world challenges and earned the title of being the world's largest single screen film event. After touring for 3 years, Mickey is also the founder of the company Elevate, a cause-driven film production which has produced hundreds of productions as television series, documentaries, feature films, and virtual videos that have reached over 1 billion views. In 2016, he traveled with Bernie Sanders to document his campaign and did the same in 2018 with Tulsi Gabbard. This year, Mickey's Plandemic series has become the most censored and yet viewed documentary of all time. His website is elevate.us. Nice to have you with us, Dave.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I would like to focus more on the second Plandemic film because Judy Mikovits was on this program on two separate occasions earlier, shortly after the first film. But I also personally feel the content of this new film in the series is far more urgent, which deals in part with the broader vaccine agenda and the global influence of Bill Gates and his billions of dollars over government's health ministries and agencies. For example, we have been led to believe that the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, is capable of infecting or killing everyone on the planet. We've subsequently found that is not true. But the government, taking the initial statistics of infections and deaths without looking deeper to see what was the actual cause of death. Did someone have the COVID-19 virus, or was it the cause of the death? Those initial studies were not done. Now that they are being done in Italy, in Spain, in other countries, we're seeing that at least 50% of the deaths, minimally, were due to coexisting comorbidities, meaning diabetes, emphysema, cancers, dementia, etc. And there was no specific test to determine they died because of the coronavirus, but they were all lumped together as coronavirus. And that led to policies that were draconian. Some would call them totalitarian, just closing down the world economy for all intents and purposes. Now, that said, no one is apologizing, and no one is taking credit for having been wrong. And yet the same group of people who mismanaged this are the people telling us that we need to have a vaccine and a new miracle drug, both the drug to treat the disease and the vaccine to prevent it. And yet, as we speak, there are none of these more than 150 minimal vaccines that could go as high as 300 that are being worked on, that have gone through the standard vaccine safety and efficacy tests, which themselves are open to criticism. So I'd like for you to take your time, please, and put the pieces together one at a time. First, from your research, and what I liked about Plandemic, the second one I saw, was that for every statement made, you had some form of documentation. That's the big difference between people giving their personal opinion, which can be accurate or inaccurate, bias in part or whole, versus a peer-reviewed journal article or a final statistic that shows what was right or wrong about something. So tell us now the most important points from your research about what's wrong with this pandemic and the coronavirus as being the single cause of all this suffering that we're seeing in the world. What can we now disprove is not correct in part or whole? So at least we can reframe the virus and its consequences to us in a more reasonable and rational and scientific method. The forum is yours.
Well, the thing that is absolutely clear at this point that I think that we all need to really wake up to urgently is that the numbers do not add up to the reaction to the protocol, to the lockdown. It doesn't warrant it as new numbers come in, and as they'll continue to come in, more and more we'll learn that this coronavirus was less of an issue than our seasonal flu. And then we have to ask ourselves if that is the case, which it seems that that's what's being proven now, then why the lockdown? And I think the answer to that is multifaceted. There's a lot of reasons that this virus occurred at an opportune time for politics to leverage it and gain from it. But ultimately, I think that everything that was attempted is now backfiring. So one of the key agendas is clearly to kill the economy. Why? Well, because the economy was better than it's ever been, and that was Donald Trump's biggest boon that he was using to attract new voters, was the fact that there were millions of people that were finally coming back to work and had hope and the ability to feed their families. And so as much of a threat as he is to the establishment and to very certain people who have been running a game and selling out America for decades, the fact that those people are being revealed and the fact that we have thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands of sealed indictments that are going to eventually be unsealed, all this, in my opinion, from my research and also from the opinion of at this point, I would say probably over 100 people at this point, is that this is a diversionary tactic to create such an issue that people will look away from everything that's being revealed right now. And, you know, the curtain is being pulled back. So this would be the metaphor would be, you know, as Toto pulls the curtain back, you know, something massive happens behind Dorothy and her friends to get them to look away from the little man behind the curtain. It's you know, ultimately that's what's taking place.
I'd like to focus in on a few specific areas, please, and let's go back into this in a little more detail. For example, one of the things we're finding is that Anthony Fauci is not the great savior and should not be revered as he is, because I remember Fauci when I was writing and researching, doing documentaries on the AIDS epidemic that we had. And I want to share with you from the Huffington Post a piece on Fauci, and I will vouch that this is accurate. Quote, whitewashing AIDS history. Now, mind you, he did this with AIDS with devastating consequences, and he's doing the same thing now with COVID. Quote, Dr. Anthony Fauci is rewriting history. He is doing so to disguise his shameful role in delaying promotion of an AIDS treatment that would have prevented tens of thousands of deaths in the first years of the epidemic. In my book, Body Counts, a memoir of politics, sex, AIDS, and survival, I recount how slow the federal government was in publicizing the use of Bactrim and other sulfa drugs to prevent PCP, the pneumonia that was the leading killer of people with AIDS, in addition to its long-time and well-known use to treat PCP. I point to Dr. Fauci in particular because he was and remains today the head of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and head of the federal government's AIDS research program. In 1987, pioneering AIDS activist Michael Callan begged Fauci for help in promoting the use of Bactrim as PCP prophylaxis and issuing interim guidelines urging physicians to prophylax those patients deemed at high risk for PCP. But Fauci refused to do that. Whether Fauci personally had the authority or not isn't the point. His excuse would be laughable if it wasn't so tragic. He was constantly traveling and speaking to the media and opining about everything related to AIDS research and treatment. In author Kahn's book, Writers Wars, Larry Kramer pointed out they get an appointment with Fauci. One didn't call his secretary, but his press officers, who booked his talks and interviews like movie stars. He could easily have advocated awareness of the preventative treatment as the de facto federal aid czar. His influence wasn't as enormous. Had Fauci listened, this is the important point, had Fauci listened to people with AIDS and the clinicians treating them and responded accordingly, he would have saved thousands of lives. In the 2 years between 1987, when Kaelin met with Fauci, in 1989, when the guidelines were ultimately issued, nearly 17,000 people with AIDS suffocated from PCP. Most of the people might have lived had Fauci responded appropriately. Now, why is that important? Because at the same time, at the Tri-State Healing Center in New York City, I was working with 1,200 people with full-blown AIDS. I never charged a penny. They were all treated for free. My board-certified physicians and nurses, nurse practitioners, were using specific non-invasive protocols. Now, we did use Bactrim, and it did help with PCP, but we were using high-dose intravenous vitamin C along with other natural therapies and antiviral foods and juices, etc. We were able to have not a single patient die in a 15-year period, not one, and 15 of those people completely reversed their HIV status. Fauci was made aware of that. We sent him all the information. We sent Gallo the information. We sent it to every source at the FDA, U.S. Public Health Service, CDC, not a single response. And yet, these were sent by our medical staff, the patients themselves. So I did a series of press conferences, bringing over 100 people to tell their story and the personal physicians. Nobody from the media attended. Now, why is that important? Because today, Fauci, Trump, and others advocate, and the CDC and media, all the media, do not use hydroxychloroquine in combination with zinc or anything else. It doesn't work. It's dangerous. Period. And yet we have all these scientists who say, and physicians, yes, it does work. And one of the leading epidemiologists in the world says it not only works, it is the single most powerful and important drug I've ever seen in my career on any condition. It's that strong. Now, put these together, and what do we have? We have the treatment for AIDS could have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Nobody would accept it, even examine it, because it was natural, nobody could patent it. Fauci was at the head of that. Today, we have proven drugs, at least four, in common use that could be saving lives prophylactically for those who are at risk, and those who take it within the first 7 days, it could save their lives by a huge percentage, and yet it's being denigrated instead of promoted. Fauci's behind that, as well as Bill Gates. So this is not the first time that we've seen a major crisis mismanaged, but the people who mismanaged the first one are mismanaging this one. It'd be like asking George Bush and Rumsfeld and the others who mismanaged and got us into the weapons of mass destruction war to come back and tell us what our foreign policy would be today. Nobody would accept that. That wouldn't be realistic. So tell us what you know about and found, discovered about Fauci, his conflicts, Bill Gates, his conflicts, and the truth about your research on what would help people with the coronavirus is being denied.
Well, you mentioned so many good points there, Gary. And I'll back up a little bit by saying that I was awakened to some of these issues within our global medical systems in the 80s. So as a young man in my early 20s, my brother had AIDS and my mother had cancer, and I watched them both die in the same month, and both of them due to bad treatments. And I remember when that happened that a lot of my brother's community at the time were telling us that we needed to look deeper into this Anthony Fauci character, and they were assuring us that, you know, I had my brother's friends tell me, your brother did not die of the virus, your brother died of either bad medicine or good medicine being withheld. And I never forgot that, of course, but we didn't have the ability at that time to do the research, and, you know, there was no internet to jump on there. So, and we were in mourning at that point of, you know, losing brother and mother in the same month. We just kind of wanted to put it all behind us. But when I met Judy and that name came up again, I remembered what I had learned in the 80s. And it was amazing to me that same person was still operating at such a high level and overseeing the health of all people and really being praised by celebrities and just like he was in the 80s, you know, he had Elton John and all these, you know, gay friendly community around him just to try to make him feel like a good guy to the gay community. All the while, there were a lot of horrible things that happened, you know, the way that they demonized the gay community and really made it, you know, created narratives that it was just this horrific kind of bathhouse disease that was only, you know, contracted by people that were promiscuous and prostitutes and all of this stuff, and just really kind of demonized anyone who got it such that when they got it, they were like a leper. And so there's a lot of social stuff that also took place beyond the criminal withholding of medicines and stuff like that. There were a lot of really horrific narratives that Anthony Fauci was happy to spin and push in that era. And here he is again, spinning and pushing all these other false narratives, and has been wrong more times than I think it's possible to count at this point. And also has a real gift. If you really pay attention to Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates, they have a very similar quality of, there's a certain charisma about them that makes you want to believe them and want to trust them. And part of their hustle is the way they use language. If you really pay attention, Anthony Fauci will have on record him saying an answer to just about every scenario, even if it contrasts itself. So, and I don't know if this is for liability purposes or exactly why he does it, but you know, he'll be on record saying masks absolutely work, and then he'll be on record saying masks absolutely serve no purpose. He does this a lot. There's a real slippery kind of communication skill that he has, and I think it's so that he can constantly point towards these moments, and that should be a real crumb on the path for us all to at least, you know, begin to question the man's motives and why is he so inconsistent and inaccurate with a lot of the things he says. He's either completely incompetent, which he's not. He's a very brilliant man. Or he's learned through the decades how to frame things such that he escapes liability, appeases his followers, and also confuses his naysayers. There's some stuff happening there that I think we all need to really pay attention to. But the bottom line is, after all of my research, and not just my research, I on Plendemic 2, I had over 20 researchers at one point, investigators, former big media journalists and legal experts and patent experts and top scientists and everybody that were helping vet every point that we made in this, because the first one was ridiculed so intensely, we wanted to make sure this one was bulletproof, and it totally is. Every fact checker has failed to try to find one point that's inaccurate in Plandemic 2. But that said, you know, it is clear to all of us, the whole research team and myself, after adding everything up, looking at all of the videos of Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci and everything that they've said and past history through other pandemics and viruses and the way things are handled, and the fact that there's this repeating narrative over and over of medicine that is unable to be patented, medicine that is inexpensive to the people, being withheld from the people while they wait for a patentable vaccine. Or they at least use the excuse, like I think a lot of them waiting for a vaccine right now is actually using it as an excuse to prolong the lockdown, to further harm the economy, and to further serve, you know, the political agenda that they're all covertly part of. I don't think we're just really, truly waiting for a vaccine as much as we are using it as an excuse to do further harm.
In today's New York Times, or yesterday's, COVID-19 live update. FDA chief highlights circumstances for early vaccine approval. The FDA chief confirms his agency's willingness to approve a vaccine before human trials are complete. I consider that the single most irresponsible scientific policy in American history, because we don't have freedom of choice in New York State, in Virginia, in California. They've already stated that they will have compulsory mandatory vaccination for all residents. Children, adults, doesn't matter. That in and of itself goes against the Nuremberg articles provided at Nuremberg that says that we will never again use anything on a person's body without informed consent. And this is clearly taking over a person's body. Then we're told what's in the different vaccines, and it's a horror story. Could you go through what your research and the experts you interviewed found out about this vaccine that is now being fast-tracked by Trump because he wants to use it to boost up his chance of being elected by saying, look what I did. But the fact that when you start giving billions of people an experimental vaccine, when already we have evidence of vaccines, even that were properly tested, not being safety tested because they don't require a placebo-controlled safety test. And that's because of a law that they got passed in 1986 on their behalf to indemnify them from harm. So they're doing the minimal amount. No other drug that you make, not a statin drug, not an antipsychotic medication, everything else has to have a certain type of test, clinical trials, not vaccines. They're given a pass on the safety aspect. So we are very concerned of unreported, undiagnosed problems with vaccine, and that's with people who were taking them thinking they were the right thing. Now a lot of people wouldn't have a choice. So could you imagine in the United States, let's just say for argument's sake, that half the population, or about 165 million Americans, were vaccinated with an untested, fully, I should say, tested vaccine. We could see injuries and lifelong problems or deaths on an unimaginable scale, dwarfing anything in the way of deaths caused strictly by COVID-19. Your thoughts, please.
Well, yes, it's you know, my thoughts are also in alignment with the dozens of doctors that I've interviewed over the past 4 months. This is including renowned scientists, Nobel laureates, and I've asked them very similar questions about this. What, you know, how do they feel about a vaccine being rushed to market without proper testing and all of that? And all of them just, you know, they use descriptives like it's just absurd, it's crazy, it's insane, it can't be done, it's never been done, it shouldn't be done, and it will lead to, you know, look down the road, us looking back and having be filled with regret for this decision that's being made. And, you know, And these are the points that I can say are have been the breaking points for every doctor that I've interviewed. Hydroxychloroquine was a really big one. I've had several doctors say that was the straw that broke the camel's back. It's hard to convince medical industry doctors, veteran doctors who have been prescribing a certain medication, a tried and true medicine for over 40 years or so. Some of them I had talked with had been prescribing it for over 40 years, and one of them said with one side effect that they've discovered, two patients had upset stomachs and the rest, you know, were experienced nothing but improvements. And so these, when they're messing with the narrative around these medicines, trying to make untested vaccines, acceptable, and then trying to call tried and true tested medicines anecdotal or unsafe for all of this, they've really lost the professional medical industry at this point. And so the doctors, you know, that 100% of them literally have all said that it's the idea of rushing a vaccine to market is absolutely insanity. And it really flies in the face of the most important part of this communication around vaccines and everything that's happening with this narrative to push mandatory vaccines, and that is the bottom line is we're completely sabotaging our own natural defense systems. And this is going to be a long-term issue, mark my words, that we will look back on. And I do believe that it is the conscious agenda of some people. When humanity as an organism continues to use synthetic drugs that ultimately inform our natural immune system that we don't need it. That's our immune system responds when it's needed. When we create a firewall between our natural immune system and our environment, that it no longer has to be active to do its job, it doesn't evolve and grow and expand and strengthen with our bodies the way it needs to. And so what ends up happening is then that the body becomes programmed to being dependent upon these synthetic drugs. And eventually our DNA is going to shift such that our immune system, go to sleep permanently, and we become lifelong customers, dependent upon additives and unnatural things to survive our ever-changing and toxic environment. And that is the most alarming and serious thing that we all need to take a look at. But when they stir up so much fear, so much paranoia, and they create such an urgent circumstance, our ability to critical think, to stop and to really feel into the situation and determine whether or not it's correct for our bodies, because this is not a one-size-fits-all. Medicine is not a one-size-fits-all thing. We have to really feel into it individually. We don't have time for that. We're too panicked. There's too much urgency, and that's why they rush these things, and they want, you know, the mask mandates and all of that is to make the environment feel so serious, so scary, that we'll be happy to, just so we can go back to normal, go ahead, let's give it a shot, stick that needle in my arm, and hopefully this cures everything. But the odds are far against that happening. The odds say that it's going to be something that puts us in worse shape than we are now, more vulnerable to future viruses, opportunistic viruses, and pandemics.
I appreciate that, Nikki. You're listening to Nikki Willis. Mickey Willis is an award-winning documentarian of Plandemic, part one and part two. We're talking about part two now. And I want to pull together your thoughts on what you alluded to. You alluded to the fact that you believe that some of the people motivated in the pandemic, or excuse me, in the COVID pandemic, may have ulterior motives. For example, Bill Gates, his overall influence in directing the narrative over not just the COVID pandemic, but in the global strategy. Would you please speak of the larger picture here and your interpretation of Gates? And keep in mind, Gates' relationship with Planned Parenthood and his depopulation agenda. That is not conspiracy theory. That is actual fact. Take us on that journey now, please.
Well, you know, we had a whole segment within part two that went deeply into Bill Gates' father, William H. Gates Sr., his history with Planned Parenthood and all of that. And I decided to pull it out of the movie because it's very important in this urgent moment that we create a bridge to the naysayers, because it's the masses that watch the wrong media channels that are having a hard time hearing us right now as we warn them. And so for me, it was more urgent to and more important of a message to language it in such a way that it wouldn't turn them off. And I'm highly aware of the way that our language has been weaponized, such that it just takes a word to trigger people and have them check out, and they're gone, and they don't get the message, and they suffer as a result of that. So we pulled out the part about eugenics because we knew that it would further, you know, pull us into that narrative of being conspiracy theorists and all of that. And so I had to go light on that. I had to go light on any mention of the CIA or stuff like that, even though it's incredibly real, totally documented. But people are so primed to resist all that talk. So, but here's, I love the opportunity to be able to speak about it now, because here's what I discovered through the process is that without a doubt, so William H. Gates Sr. was the head of Planned Parenthood. Not everyone knows this. He was the head of Planned Parenthood. And during an era, too, we have to remember when one of their initiatives was actually called the Negro Project. And 75% of the Planned Parenthoods were being erected in black neighborhoods. We should also fast forward to let your listeners know that just recently, Margaret Sanger has been called out as a racist, so much that the far-left mobs that are canceling everybody and tearing down statues have finally now spoken up, and Planned Parenthood has now issued a press release distancing themselves from their founder, Margaret Sanger, because it is at this point indisputable that she was a very well-known, outspoken racist. And so if Bill Gates' father was partners with Margaret Sanger and you know, head of her board, was running Planned Parenthood, and she is a known racist, should we not be suspicious of Bill Gates' father? And if we're suspicious of Bill Gates' father, should we not take a closer look at all of the harm that Bill Gates, the son of William H. Gates Sr., has done in third world countries that are occupied by brown and black people? Is this not worthy of us to inspect this, to say, is there a connection? Because Bill Gates is also on camera saying that he was incredibly inspired by his father, particularly his father's work with Planned Parenthood. And so if that is Bill Gates' inspiration to do what he's doing, then we need to take a deeper look at the man's deeper agenda to exterminate people of color, because it sure seems it looks that way. And I have interviewed dozens of people that have worked on the ground, some of them as wranglers, when they would come in into third world countries and do illegal vaccine trials. They were hired and paid as wranglers, people that could go into their villages and pull out people and unknowingly lie to these people and tell them, you're going to come and get vitamin shots, come on in, and it's all good, it's going to make your children healthier. These people I've spoken to say, oh yeah, they once they realized what they had done, they're living with the pain of knowing that they caused sterilization and paralyzation of thousands of young people, because they too themselves were bamboozled. And so at this point, as much as I want to believe Bill Gates and I want to buy into the narrative that one of the richest men in the world is doing something wonderful to save humanity, there's nothing that I found, nor my research team has found, to validate that narrative. Everything points in the opposite direction. Every investment that he has is suspect. If for a man who cares so much about farming and crops and all of that, why is he invested in some of the most, the worst polluters on the planet, the worst companies, the companies that cause obesity and cancer, and he's invested in all of these horrible, the most toxic industries on the planet, and at the same time, he's pushing a narrative that he wants to make the world healthier and safer. They don't add up. And it's unbelievable to me sometimes that people can't see that. It's not at least creating, you know, suspicion in them to look deeper. And I think the reason for that is that Bill Gates is one of the best actors that have ever lived. He learned from a very early age. He was thrust into the spotlight. His character even shifted. If you look at old video of Bill Gates as a teenager, as a young man, he was very hip. He was like you would call a hippie, right? I mean, he had long hair. He looked very different than he does. You know, he kind of inverted into this, this extreme nerd kind of character with the sweaters and everything. And to me, it feels like it's a Hollywood created persona that he's become very, very good at playing. So good that despite all of this evidence, despite the tens of thousands of people that were testified, despite the fact that we've had, trials in India where it was proven that he had bribed people, that they had lied, and that they had, without consent, they had jabbed people with vaccines and ruined their bodies for lives. All this stuff has been documented and proven, and has actually gone to, you know, trials that have heard it and have decided that Bill Gates will not come back and do this again in our country. Yet somehow 10 years later, everyone forgets about it, and the fear gets risen to such a height that I guess they just can't, you know, clearly think about it. And he comes back and he does it again. And that's what's happening right now.
Mickey, there's two points I'd like you to go further in depth on. First, it's not speculation. It's historical fact that in at least three African countries, especially Tanzania, the doctors found that there was a luteinizing hormone that was in the vaccines that could cause sterility. And that came through the Gates vaccine program. And that also had been found in other countries as well. So it meant that someone had put the policy together to create a vaccine that would sterilize, make them unable to bear children. And that has been fully documented. So take us back to Africa and the so-called disease prevention, because just this week, the International Health Organization declared Africa is free of wild polio. So again, the false idea that herd immunity through vaccination has been a success. Same story we heard with smallpox and polio in this country. So tell us your experience in India and the Gates vaccine operations. And do you feel the Democrats have captured the pandemic narrative for their own political agenda for no other purpose than to defeat Trump?
Well, you know, both India and Africa have been hit incredibly hard and left in a place of absolute devastation with paralyzed and, as you mentioned, sterilized children. And I mean, in the thousands. The Indian Parliament, when they had ruled against Bill Gates and the vaccine trials that happened there, at that particular case, there were 27,000 kids that were harmed and seven that had died. In a previous trial, there were 500,000, upwards of 600,000 kids, young ladies with HPV vaccine that had serious injuries as a result of that trial. And so, but your last question, I will jump to that regarding, you know, the political aspect of this, without a doubt. And as you mentioned, when you read off my bio, it's important for people to understand right now I'm being, you know, smeared all through the press as some, you know, far right neo-Nazi conspiracy theorist and all of that. And that's expected, because that's, when they don't have any real dirt on you, those are the smears, those are the go-to smears. So, you know, that's expected. But the truth of the matter is I've been a far left activist for almost 20 years. And on the road with Democratic presidential candidates, you know, traveled all through 2016 from Los Angeles to Philadelphia with Bernie, and spent very intimate time on the road with Tulsi Gabbard as she was running this last year. And what I can tell you is that I am no longer a Democrat. I have walked away from the party, or as many people say, the party walked away from me. And I've watched this further descent into, you know, this radical ideologies that are propped up by the narrative that all of America is racist, all white men are racist, that it's impossible to be racist against white people, like these absurd narratives that prohibit us from engaging in any real dialogue, any constructive civil debates, because we don't belong in certain conversations due to our skin color. So it's literally the revamping of racism all over again. And so that's one of my major issues with the political party. Understanding as a media veteran over 30 years that I've been producing media, having been in boardrooms with some of the top news agencies, having earned their trust because, you know, I was once on the far left, earn their trust such that they will speak candidly in front of me, I can tell you that it is a wicked, wicked agenda that the media is up to. And they will say and do anything, which I think is pretty evident by now, to serve its corporate overlords. And it doesn't matter that these people aren't journalists. They should not be confused with journalists. They are entitled to none of the constitutional protection that a journalist is entitled to. These are people posing as journalists that get paid millions and millions of dollars under really strict NDA-style gag orders to remain silent as to the ways that their industry is run and to the private conversations they have behind closed doors, which I've been privy to some of them. And it is a very psychologically manipulative approach that they take to not only selling products that humans, that we don't need, convincing us that we're consumers and not creators, but to also to get us to vote the way they want us to vote and to surrender to policies that we wouldn't surrender to if we were operating from a place from common sense. And so, you know, there's no doubt at this point that the Democratic Party has been hijacked by far-left radicals on a socialist agenda. And I'll tell you honestly, is when I was on the road with Bernie Sanders, I had bought into the narrative that, well, this is different. This is democratic socialism. This is, you know, and I would have some people reaching out to me saying, no, people from other countries saying, don't believe that. This is a tool, that a stepping stone towards communism. And I thought, these people are just paranoid. I'd have people from Venezuela and Cuba and all these different, you know, Korea, different places calling me, telling me, you know, I respect you. I've followed your work for years, and I want to let you know you are, you know, on the wrong track right now. And they were right. I was wrong. It took me all the way to Philadelphia and listening to the numerous interviews that I was conducting while on the road, traveling in RVs and tour buses and following the whole Bernie campaign and interviewing anyone from just young people following his campaign to other politicians and policymakers and celebrities and people that were also part of this caravan. And the one thing I noticed, with very few exception, is that there was a common agreement within this collective that America was a bad place, that it was founded on theft and genocide and racism, and all they talked about was how horrific America was and is. And it no one talked about our accomplishments of the way that we've course corrected like no other nation before. No one talked about the fact that violent crime and rape and poverty and so many things were on the decline massively, that we are improving our way of life. None of the positive statistics regarding any of it. It was just there. Everybody was being indoctrinated into this idea that anyone with pigment in their skin is oppressed and hunted and disrespected, and so are women, and that the evil people that sustain this, which turned out to be people that look like me, white men, are the enemy. And I thought, wow, for a man that was raised on welfare with a single mother, with a gay brother, which is what lured me into the, you know, far left ideologies, you know, because I believe that that's who took care of us when we were children. You know, they're the ones who supported us with welfare and all of that. No, that I do understand now how detrimental those political policies like welfare. It's all about dependency. My mother was incentivized to never remarry. She was incentivized to never have a man in the house. And because there was never a man in the house, I was raised without a father. And as a result, it's a miracle that I didn't end up dead or in prison, because I went out of control as a teenager. And I'm grateful that I was able to come back and have visited that end of the spectrum to be the man and the father and the husband that I am today. But a lot of people don't make it back. And under looking back at that now and realizing that the very policies that I thought were helping us were actually harming my mother, crushing her dreams, crushing her desire to be in love again and be married again and to die with, you know, a man in her life, be in a relationship. It never happened again. Instead, she died of cancer. And that is a product of the system, of the corruption and the toxic system that we're fighting against right now. And so all of that is what motivated me to look deeper. And then I end up finding myself in the profession of the media, which I never thought I'd ever be. And it just happened. And I think it happened out of my desire to understand it and to reform it, quite honestly, because I do believe that the American media, the U.S. media right now, is the enemy of the people. It's doing extreme damage to our nation, to our psyche, to our children, and all of life.
Mickey, I appreciate those deep and personal, intimate insights. Thank you. I want to highlight something you just said. When you were talking about the bias in the media and that you wanted the left to be something that, growing up as an idealist, you had hoped that it would be. But now we see that identity politics has destroyed so much of what has been built up over the last 50 years. I mentioned this in a commentary a few weeks ago, that if Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and others, who were nonviolent in their approach but very pragmatic, because they were hated by the liberal community, if you remember, that they would have a different message today. Gandhi would have a different message today. He would not be burning buildings. And the irony of it is, burning small businesses, over 2,000 have been burned. Almost the majority of those are for minority people, Asian Americans, you know, Chinese Americans, Indian Americans, African Americans, Latino Americans. How do you resolve an issue with the police by burning down an innocent person's business, beating them up?
Mm-hmm.
You don't, that's not how you make positive change. But we have made positive change. People have more rights today, more freedoms today than they've ever had in American history. And when there's been an imbalance in one area, we have gone to the streets. I've led over 1,000, been a participator, led over 1,000 demonstrations. All nonviolent, all constructive, all meant to give the people a second opinion. You believe this? Would you at least examine that? The last one was on 5G. I was demonstrating. I led a demonstration in New York City about 10 months ago. I've been out of the city for a long time. How bad is 5G? Well, you do that by educating them. You know, you're watching the commercials, you think 5G is the greatest thing. It connects us. No, it's not. It imprisons us. Look behind the scenes. So taking people behind the scenes to show them the truth is what a real journalist does. And we don't have, in the mainstream, we don't have any real journalists. On the outside, Chris Hedges, yes, we have Abby Martin. We have a lot of good outside the mainstream journalists. But they're not given a forum anymore. They've been deplatformed. And that's the irony of all this. Now, on Friday, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. held a press conference in Berlin, and he talked about starting a children's health defense fund in Germany and kicking it off with the challenging COVID and the vaccines and 5G and cashless currency, all of which combine to make you something out of an Orwellian novel, but you put yourself into that Orwellian nightmare by being in the Soma nightmare that Aldous Huxley was talking about in the mid-1930s, meaning the drugs give you an altered state, and therefore you don't have to think critically. You're only allowed to think to the degree that your medications provide you with something that soothes all of the angst in your life. And so we're looking for escapism at a time when we should be looking for critical thought. That said, he predicted this. He said on Saturday, in one of the largest demonstrations, about 40,000 people, and not wearing masks, peacefully demonstrating, and he said, what do you want to bet that later today and tomorrow, CNN and the other reports will talk about a small number, 3,500 far right-wing and nationalists and neo-Nazis met, and they're all conspiracy theorists. And that's exactly what CNN, the other, and the New York Times reported. Now, for those of us who are watching the demonstrations in real time, because had I been in New York and available to travel, I would have been there. And yet, it's what the media chooses to leave out of a story that shows you where the story is going, and therefore what has been captured politically. Let me give you examples, and then I'd like you to respond to it, please.
Sure.
Not a single mention of any of the innocent people whose businesses were destroyed in all these riots. No word from them, not one, as if they don't count. Lying that this even happened, Jerry Nadler says, it's just a myth that, you know, there's violence. Looking at a violent activity and calling it a peaceful protest as versus a peaceful protest. You know, if it's a peaceful protest, good, we all want that. But then aligning yourself with the people who are the problem, Wall Street, the banking society, the big industrial complex, the military industrial complex, not a single member of either the Republican or Democratic parties are voting against this humongous budget that could de-ghettoize all of America and bring some prosperity and work and hope back and quality of life. If we gave the money from the military industrial complex, the medical industrial complex, the energy industrial complex, and gave it back to the neighborhoods and to apply it there. But the media doesn't cover the story. The politicians don't talk about it. There is nothing in the Democratic platform that really changes the environment. All the things that the Green Party actually did right, the opportunists within the Democratic Party took as a talking point, but there's nothing there to actually change anything. It's like the ultimate capitalist green movement with people who are such frauds like Al Gore heading it. Al Gore doesn't give a damn about anything except himself. Yes, does he care about global warming? Yes, he does. But he doesn't care enough to stop his private jets. He doesn't care enough to go vegan. He doesn't care enough about supporting wave power. But he supports his own hedge fund that invests in solar panels. Yeah, and so behind the scenes, it's all hypocrisy, and they're trying to make it seem like let's make sure that COVID is kept everyone so terrified that you can control them, and it was Hermann Göring. Sure. At the Nuremberg trials, who said, when the prosecution asked, how did you get 50 million Germans to agree that annihilating an entire group of people, the Jews, also the Gypsies and communists and Africans, was acceptable? He said, simple. It's easy. You can do it anywhere. Get people to be so afraid that you come in as the person who's going to alleviate their fears. You've pointed out where the problem is, and now you're going to solve it, and they'll go right along with it. And he was unfortunately correct. So today, by terrorizing us when the figures of death do not comport with the actual being caused, except for 6%, and that is a big lie that they've said, all these deaths. Well, are you counting deaths from heart attacks and strokes and car accidents and pneumonia? Yes, they are. Well, then you're engaged in fraud. Why won't the media expose that? Because the media is the problem. And as a result, everywhere you look, they've weaponized all dialogue. If you're not in alignment with them, they attack you. Now, finally, I want you to go into depth about, since I've produced many, over 600 awards in my documentaries, over 80 documentaries, I realize that film is one of the most powerful forms of media at your disposal. Of course, our opponents use it in the same way to propagandize their agendas as well. So film is just as susceptible to the war between truth and falsehoods as is radio, the television networks, and the internet blogosphere. So why is film so powerful, and do you see ways that film can be used even more persuasively and conscientiously for achieving constructive social changes, and ultimately, it's getting people in the streets and encouraging them to make socially responsible changes in their personal lives that bring sustainable change. Now you're being attacked. They're doing all. Everywhere I look, you are the number one enemy out there. Man, they're going after you.
Yeah.
I mean, every media, every blogosphere, they've got sock puppets and agent provocateurs all over you. So I'm sure. And yet, you are still able to do something that they have not done, and that is tell the truth. So tie those two things together in the last 5 minutes of our program, please.
Well, first of all, Gary, I just want to say that I'm really blown away by your level of knowledge and the way that you hold the container for these complex conversations. It's so refreshing. So it's an honor to be engaged in this dialogue with you.
Thank you.
They're having a hard time with me because I'm not an easy guy to put in a box, especially the box they want to put me in. And so the fact that I have the ability to make viral media that reaches millions of people, and also that I come from the far left and I don't have the dirt or anything that I've done that they can point to and have people legitimately, you know, distrust me, they have to create a lot of false scenarios and just resort to character smears and you know the game is, you know, which they've done to Trump and so many people, you know, it's like let's hold Trump accountable for when he's wrong. Let's definitely examine, you know, suspect policies or anything like that. But when you get into a game of just trying to create hatred on someone else, it's a game that will only backfire. And they succeed for a moment, they'll win the round, but they're going to lose the tournament because I have a lot of people coming out to defend me now, people who've known me for 20, 30 plus years. And they're just starting to get the courage to come out and to defend me because they know when they start reading this stuff about me, they know it's nowhere close to being true. I'm a father. I have two children. And a lot of my life has been made public via my iPhone videos that I've been filming with me and my kids for a number of years. And, you know, with my wife on camera, she's also very visible online. She does a lot of, you know, she works with women entrepreneurs and helps women step into their empowerment and all of that. So, you know, we come from very positive backgrounds. We don't, we don't have anything dark and dirty and shady, you know, behind us. And so their game becomes, let's just make you distrust or hate this person. And you know, they've succeeded with some people. You know, there's the hate that I've received has been a tsunami from people that are just incredibly misformed. And when I try to engage with them, their mindset is such that they don't really want facts. They don't want to hear anything that might disrupt the decision that they've already made or the narrative that's been handed to them. And so that is one of the things I'm willing to stand in the fire and to be an example of this because it's, I don't think there's any better opportunity for us right now to be a live demonstration for the people of just how vile and dangerous the media can be. And the fact that they'll do this to anyone, they can demonize anyone. And the people that they demonize are anyone that dares to speak out against the agenda that they've all invested in billions, if not trillions of dollars over decades. And when you disrupt that, it's, you know, you are the enemy. And so, again, it wasn't a shock for me because I've been in media long enough to know the game that they play. And I also, you know, am feeling now that it's going to ultimately be a massive gift because not only did they smear me, but anyone who was able to watch, particularly Plandemic 2, and if anyone who's educated enough and have done a little bit of their own research knows at a glance that Plandemic 2 is spot on and that there's not one claim made in that can be ruled as false. And now we have millions of people sharing that and they're getting censored and smeared and shut down. And so what that's ultimately causing is, you know, sometimes we don't care about things until it happens to us. And now it's happening to millions of people across the world, and it's causing them to go, wait a minute here. If I'm now being censored and smeared, and I know the truth, maybe I need to take with a grain of salt every other smear against other people out there, because what I'm seeing more and more is that our world has been, in the narrative, that is, has been totally inverted, so that we listen to people and hail them as heroes, the Bill Gates and the Anthony Faucis of the world, and you know, the Nancy Pelosi's of the world, you know, when it's like, no, those people are doing great damage to our nation, and they continue to lie to us. These talking heads on mainstream media that have just over and over, at the course of just especially the course of the last 4 years, every investigation and trial and all these narratives that they've, you know, it's driven the people crazy, especially the people who follow and believe in these people. I think it's honestly driven them crazy, because they've their emotions have been brought up so many times. You know, the walls are closing in, the people are going to go to prison, this is what's happening, we're just about to, and none of it happens. And it actually turns out that, you know, it's the other side that's actually created the treason, has done the spying, has done the lying, has colluded with Russia and Ukraine. It's like everything that they've accused, you know, one side for, they've been doing. And I don't consider myself at this point on either side. I can't be a responsible journalist and filmmaker and label myself on one side or another. I'm now going to remain very neutral in the middle, where I can see the shortcomings of the Republican Party. I can see the shortcomings of the Democratic Party. Of the Libertarian Party, all of it, and I am in service to truth. And if the truth, whatever side the truth falls on, that's the side I'm going to support for that specific point only.
Good for you, Mickey. I just want to close out with, I read Wikipedia's entry for Plandemic, which is the first in the series that focused on Judy Mikovits, and noted how the Center for Inquiry, that's the flagship organization for the militant skeptic movement that includes Paul Offit, uh-huh. Benjamin Radford, and Richard Dawkins, uh-huh. and other radical scientific materialists and leaders of the new atheist movement, are taking you to task. Now, we're familiar with these folks. Richard Gale and I have written over 72 articles deconstructing any legitimacy of Wikipedia, and written several letters, 9 letters to their lawyers. We do not consider it a legitimate encyclopedia by any measure. It's more today like a Soviet gulag, and no amount of effort to get the Wikipedia Foundation's legal department to bail you out will succeed. And so far, skeptics have carte blanche control over the pages they create and then monitor and control. And everybody tries to work, but the good news is we have just released a petition with thousands of names, some of the Nobel Prize winners and some of the top scientists and people in the world, like Professor Sheldrake, Rupert Sheldrake, and Deepak Chopra, a lot of people, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., et cetera. And now we're going to their funders, thousands of funding individuals and organizations. We're sending this letter to. It's a very polite letter. All we can do is encourage them to look at our evidence that Wikipedia has its own political and ideological agenda, and it's not positive, it's not fair, and doesn't follow any of its stated positions of neutrality. The hope is that Wikipedia realizes that we, meaning those of us, and I'm the canary in the coal mine, I'm the one leading all this, and the rest are waiting because all of them have been slandered, like yourself, libeled, but with no opportunity to correct anything. And then that leads to the lawsuits against the individual editors. Those are susceptible people. And then we also have inside whistleblowers providing us with a lot of information that they cannot now erase or eliminate. We have it. So just understand that just like on Saturday, we're between Denmark, Rome, Berlin, and London. There were probably, I'm guesstimating, around 100,000 demonstrators peacefully demonstrating, but telling the world, we're not taking it anymore, your lies and manipulation about coronavirus, the politicalization of this condition. We're also going after Wikipedia. And on your behalf, we will also be fighting, and we'll let you know the battle and how it's going. But no longer can Wikipedia and its editors just stand and mock and ridicule anonymously people who have actually made legitimate contributions to the world when they've made nothing.
That's wonderful to hear, Gary. I really appreciate that. I'd even ask that I've had a lot of requests to respond to the Center for Inquiry and Paul Offit's critique of Plandemic One. I've been so busy, leading up to the release of Part Two that I wasn't able to do that yet. If there's any of your listeners or yourself or anyone, I think it's time that we respond line by line to their original Center for Inquiry debunk of Part One. And so if there's anyone that wants to be part of that, please let us know, and
Mickey,
let's do it together.
Mickey, Richard Gale and I will go to bat for you. All right?
Thank you.
We'll do it because we know Paul Offit, and we have done this. We've deconstructed every single argument that they have made about any form of alternative or complementary medicine and healing. We'll help you with your challenge. All right? Thank you for being on today.
Thank you, Gary.
Mickey Willis, that's M-I-K-K-I. And if you have not yet watched Plandemic 2, please do so. And we look forward to another conversation. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.
Brother, there's far too many.